Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. We're joined for the hour by author and professor, Dr. Elliot D. Cohen. Please stay with us. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slavery for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of your brothers and your sisters. We won. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got the love of our brothers and our sisters.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, and the apocalypse.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour with Professor Dr. Elliot D. Cohen. His book from 2014, one of many, is titled Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. Elliot D. Cohen received a PhD from Brown University. He's one of the principal founders of philosophical counseling in the United States. He's also founder and editor of the International Journal of Applied Philosophy and the International Journal of Philosophical Practice, as well as the ethics editor of Free Inquiry magazine. He co-founded and is executive director for the National Philosophical Counseling Association, and he is president of the Institute of Critical Thinking, a national center for logic-based therapy. Dr. Cohen has written 25 books and numerous articles in philosophical counseling, applied philosophy, and applied ethics. His books include The Theory and Practice of Logic-Based Therapy, The Dutiful Worrier, How to Stop Compulsive Worry Without Feeling Guilty, The New Rational Therapy, Thinking Your Way to Serenity, Success, and Profound Happiness, and What Would Aristotle Do? Self-Control Through the Power of Reason. His books and articles have been translated into several languages, and Elliot Cohen also writes on ethics. He is a Project Censored affiliate professor, and he submits ethics updates and stories about censored and underreported stories for Project Censored. He is also author of numerous books on surveillance and national security. His most recent book, Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance, was out in 2014 by Palgrave Macmillan. Dr. Elliot Cohen joins us today by phone. Elliot, how are you?
I'm great. Great to be here, too.
Thanks so much for coming back to the Project Censored Show, Elliot. It's great to have you. And Peter and I see your latest work here. Again, you're very amazingly detailed. And you start your book by discussing a history of mass surveillance. Can you tell us a little bit about that history and what compelled you to write this book?
Sure. What compelled me to write the book was the fact that there's media coverage apparently in abundance since post-Snowden, but it's really not media coverage in abundance because it doesn't provide any information about what the information is. That might sound like double talk, but there's a bunch of slides, you know, that were disclosed, you know, post-Snowden, but there wasn't anything that detailed what the slides were about, and for the average person, it's not clear what it even is. So my job was to provide detailed information about what's going on based upon these primary source documents. And so I went through all the different slides from NSA and analyzed them and integrated them and drew inferences from them and checked out those inferences from other sources. And it's quite a story to tell about what's going on and what people really don't know about the mass warrantless surveillance program that's going on hot and heavily now with government. So that's the one side of it. What I was hoping to do was, once I put this together, I wanted to provide some suggestions for making important changes, you know, in the technology so that it would preserve some freedom and dignity, as the title of the book suggests. Now, for the second part of your question about the history of surveillance, what's going on right now didn't arise in a vacuum. There's a history of mass surveillance, and it largely began, not to say that there wasn't any attempt to surveil, but it was largely on a single individual scale with warrants, single warrants for wiretaps. But what happened in the late 60s was the development of a system that bears the name Echelon. Have you ever heard of the term? I'm sure you have.
Oh, yes. We covered it quite well in Project Censored books back then.
That was a historical first, because what it did was it integrated a number of different systems, different posts, outposts. It was largely based upon satellite technology and waves, that microwaves that it picked up. And it was very elaborate, actually. It was more impressive than one might think, because when you think about the history of surveillance and mass surveillance, you might think, well, this started after 9/11. But the system was pretty elaborate, and it was integrated between, it was cooperatively put together between the National Security Agency in the United States and its British counterpart, the Government Communications Headquarters, the GCHQ. Actually, it was very capable of picking up large quantities, virtually all the electronic correspondence that went from sea to sea, from continent to continent. And it's very impressive with respect to an elaborate system in that period of time. And the reason why it came to be in the first place, and this I think is very significant, is that the intention was to keep an eye on the Soviet Union, keeping in mind that was still in gear in the 60s, and it wasn't until, about 1991, I think, that it disbanded. So that was the enemy then, to keep an eye on. But interestingly, and this sort of suggests how history can repeat itself, what happened was that the system wasn't just used to keep an eye on the Russians. It was actually used to listen to information that was being conveyed from politicians, from individuals, from corporations, and so forth. So it wasn't really what it was propped up to be, just for purposes of preventing a kind of attack on the United States or national security purposes. So that was an aspect.
Elliot, wasn't it even illegal at the time for NSA and the CIA to be monitoring communications of American citizens in the United States? But the British were able to do it, and then they would share the info.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what they did. What happened was the U.S. collected data for the Brits, and the Brits collected data for U.S., and so they exchanged information, and that's how they got around the law. But the spirit of the law was violated, quite obviously, notwithstanding the fact that they were not directly getting the information.
We're talking with Elliot Cohen, the author of The Technology of Oppression. And you have this term, mass warrantless surveillance networks, and certainly Echelon was one of the beginnings of that, but we've advanced technologically to levels way, way beyond that. Talk a little bit about privacy and a moral right to privacy as a person. What do you mean by that?
Well, to understand what privacy is in the first place in this context, it means that you have control over personal information, and that it requires your consent in order to disclose that information. And why is that important? Well, because this is the area where people can be themselves. They can be who they are, and as soon as you take away an individual's privacy, they can't express themselves freely, and there's a loss of dignity in that. Dignity meaning that you have the power of self-expression. So that's an important aspect of it, and for privacy to be totally destroyed, and we're talking about very slow but sure deterioration of privacy. If the government knows everything that you're doing, and we even have smart TVs that can actually look into people's living rooms, we're not talking about just being discreet, on what you say. The level of violation is ever increasing, and we can talk about some of the technologies on the pipes that will move that forward. So people are losing the opportunity to be who they are, and once that happens, and the government can decide who you are, essentially, and that's where, people need to understand that this is a growing cancer. It isn't something that's going to even remain as advanced as it is now. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, this goes back, of course, to John Poindexter and after 9/11, their desire to have total information awareness. And there was reactions to that. Certainly people were saying, oh, no, we can't be that extensive. But in fact, we have. We've moved forward. We have laws in place that say we're not supposed to spy on Americans talking to each other, but they collect everything. So if Mickey and I had a telephone conversation this week, it is recorded somewhere and could be looked up.
Well, that's good in case we forgot what we said. We could maybe contact them and find out. I forget things these days, so at least we know there's a running record of it, right, Elliot? And, I mean, of course, we say that in jest, but there really is a record of it.
Yeah, yeah. The technology that developed after Echelon was not based on satellite technology anymore, because in the late 1980s, fiber optic cables came into being and replaced copper phone lines, and these wires, of course, these cables work on digital technologies. It works through transfer of light at the speed of light. And so these cables ended up connecting continents together through undersea cables. Now, what happened was when cables ran undersea, it was very difficult. You could, but it was very difficult to tap these cables for espionage purposes, for NSA purposes, to see what's carrying them. You could have these specialized submarines and the like. It was very costly and dangerous. And when you cap one of these cables, it pours out. Got to really be very careful on how you even tap it. So, well, essentially, this led to finding places to gain the information. And the places that were picked where these cables surfaced and were at the various outposts, the telecommunication sites like AT&T and the others. And so, in effect, that's where the new technologies got its start. In 2005, Mark Klein, who was a whistleblower, as you know, for AT&T.
We're speaking with Professor Elliot D. Cohen. He's the author of 25 books. One of his more recent books is titled Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. We'll be back after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's guest is Dr. Elliot D. Cohen, author of 25 books. One of his recent books from Palgrave Macmillan is Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. And just before the break, Elliot, you started to talk about a very important person that, at least in my opinion, has been tragically overlooked by many after the revelations of people like Edward Snowden and so forth. And that's Mark Klein, the AT&T worker. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I agree with you about being overlooked. In 2010, I had written another book on mass media and mass surveillance and state control. And basically, I had much of my information I got from Mark Klein's disclosures. And much of that information really was part of the disclosures of Snowden, substantial amount of it. And so Snowden gets the credit or the discredit from the perspective of the government for making those disclosures. But Mark Klein, and what did he disclose? Well, AT&T was setting up these secret rooms in their telecommunication sites, and they were basically housing NSA computers that were downloading all this data from individuals. They weren't just telephone conversations, as it's oftentimes suggested. They were also any kind of electronic communications, including email. It was just flowing through, you know, these pipes, and that's where they keyed into it, and they downloaded and they analyzed it. So we had the beginning of this new kind of technology with various types of analytics, you know, to analyze it and to look for allegedly terrorists. And we'll talk more about that, you know, as we move on.
Well, Elliot Cohen, the book you mentioned earlier, your 2010 book, is titled Mass Surveillance and State Control, a Total Information Awareness Project. I wanted to make sure listeners had the title of that book, also Palgrave Macmillan. And this book really kind of follows up in some ways from your work on mass surveillance and state control. And the thing that I really enjoy about the book we're discussing here today on privacy and so forth, it starts out with a history of mass warrantless surveillance network. And of course, I teach history, and so this is something that's very interesting to me. Could you talk to our listeners a little bit more about the Total Information Awareness Project and what role that played in all this?
That project was, as Peter mentioned, that was proposed by John Poindexter and a colleague. And essentially, that was right after the 9/11 attacks. And it was intended to promote further development of mass warrantless surveillance in this system that we're talking about. It's really, you know, one chronology of development, and that was the catalyst for that horn of development. And I think it's an interesting, you mentioned history, there's an interesting analysis here, historically speaking, and that's that Echelon was created because it was this common enemy that we had. It was the Russians, but it wasn't used exclusively on the Russians. Names and addresses and so forth of individuals are put in to check up on them. And they weren't necessarily individuals who were alleged terrorists or possible terrorists. And now what happened after 9/11, we had a new enemy. And that enemy is the Middle Easterners who are plotting terrorist attacks. And we need to watch them real carefully. But I think it's pretty clear from the data that Snowden disclosed and from other sources that it's not simply preserved for spying on individuals who are prospective terrorists. We're all in this system, and we're all being spied on and included in this system. And I really use the word spied on in a strict sense. I don't mean you're just in the system. I think, you know, that would be putting it too mild. You're actually being checked up on. Everybody has a footprint. And if you happen to be talking to somebody who spoke to somebody who spoke to somebody, or somebody calls you who called someone else that was connected with terrorism, you're in the loop. So you're a suspect. So everybody, essentially, is a suspect.
And this is everything, correct? I mean, if you use Yahoo, or you're on Facebook, or you Skype, or you have an email process, all of that is being collected, including
right.
Phone calls. And then the software, like Prism and Upstream and some others, sort through that, looking with whatever codes they have to try to identify folks that might be a threat. Has that worked at all? And how many false positives are there?
Yeah, let me get to that. And as you mentioned, the Prism and Upstream programs, and I think that's an important distinction, and it gives us an idea how this system operates, because there's really two broad types of collections that have been developed in post 9/11. And one of them, as you said, is Prism. And Prism downloads internet and voice over IP from servers of a number of different internet providers, internet companies. That includes companies like Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, even Skype, as well as Apple. And so this is the presumed legal version of the program. It's got oversight from the government, from the courts. And this is where you get this stuff from the servers from these companies. But the other program that there is the Upstream program. And there's a number of different types of programs. There are many different Upstream programs. And these intercept and upload domestic and international telephone and internet traffic, basically at switches inside telecommunication companies. And the important kicker here is while this communication is en route, you know, to the servers throughout the world. So it's not like it's downloaded in the server and then we get it from Apple or we get it from any of these other companies I mentioned. This stuff is being tapped as it's in motion, and that's why it's Upstream. It's called Upstream. Those programs use a program called XGScore, and this is the most developed form of analytic parser to date, so far as I know. It was developed by Science Applications International Corporation, and it conducts what's called deep packet analyses of data that was captured. And This data, as you said, includes emails and your attachments, as well as, you know, metadata such as names and addresses. So that gives a very rough but ready understanding of, you know, the general architecture of these types of programs.
So this massive, massive program, is it catching any bad guys? And how many false positives are there?
Is it catching any bad guys? That's a great question, because there was a study in January 2014 by the New American Foundation, and the report, and basically this is a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy institute. They don't have any dog in the fight here. And they analyzed 225 cases of individuals who were charged with terrorism after 9/11. And they found that actually 60% of these cases were initiated by conventional investigations. But by that I mean like informants, community tips, and just routine law enforcement, and stuff like that. And this program, the programs operated under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, played a role in, and these were the upstream programs that I was talking about. It was the subset of these upstream programs. And they played a role in about 4.8% of these cases. So that's the claim, that really they found that there was any connection of mass surveillance electronic technologies to about 4.8% of the cases. And then the telephone metadata program was pretty much a flop. This is a program that was operated under Section 215 of the U.S. Patriot Act. And this allowed collections of billions of phone records from Verizon customers and other companies. And it was used in only 1.8% of such cases. So it really had an efficacy rate there of 1.8. And then when you look, and this is the important point, when you look at the specific cases where it played a role, what happens is that it tended to be successful only when what we call strong selectors were put into the surveillance system. This information that was put in to find, did you actually use the system, was acquired through conventional means. So essentially, the system in itself doesn't do anything. It provides grander speed at which you can acquire the same information that you can do a wiretap on, you know, and all those billions of dollars, you know, invested in the system. And
it doesn't do anything to protect us. It certainly is doing something in terms of our privacy invasion and making us all completely vulnerable in any communications that we have. They're not ours anymore. They don't belong to us.
And to the other question that you had about the in the process of looking, you know, for these individuals, what, you know, the terrorists, what kind of false positive rate does it have? And I did a calculation of the data, you know, after, you know, in the time that the study, the New American Foundation study, was looking at these 225 cases, and in order to find the 4.8% of them, they generated, according to my calculation, I think this is a very modest calculation using what's called Bayes' theorem, and there was about 87 million false positives. 87 million false positives, which means that 87 million of us are basically terrorist suspects based upon these positives. And then what one has to do is go through this needle in a haystack, this proverbial needle in a haystack, to find the actual terrorist. And in order to do that, you need conventional, you know, information that was gained by conventional means.
So, Elliot Cohen, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but let me see if we got this right. All of this spying, all of this metadata collection that's being done in the name of protecting us from terrorism is actually doing no such thing. We're not trapping or catching terrorists, so to speak. In fact, I don't believe to date we've had any successful terrorism prosecutions under the Patriot Act. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. What it's essentially doing is providing a good means of looking for people other than terrorists.
It's Big Brother under the guise of national security, but it's...
Works great for that.
Well, certainly... yeah, I mean, again, it's a cynical laughter, I suppose. But it's really amazing, you know, the data that you have amassed yourself about just exactly how this technology is being used and really, you know, why everyday Americans and actually people all over the world should be quite concerned about it, worried about it, and should probably get involved in some capacity with groups that are really trying to help safeguard against this. And I don't just mean groups like the ACLU per se, but I also mean like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Sue Udry, Shahid Batar. I mean, there's a number of people that are really on top of this. And I mean, really, if you get on the email listservs, it's almost like every day or every week that they're sort of on to some new battle, on to some new fight, on to some new front, because Big Brother is that far ahead.
Yeah, that's right. And the technology keeps evolving, and there are technologies now. I mean, I've done a study of the different patents that are supported by DARPA to develop further technologies for purposes of doing more intrusive sorts of spying. Allegedly, they're for other purposes, but when you look at it, we know DARPA doesn't have an interest, for instance, in helping the mentally ill or providing people who have problems communicating, giving them artificial prostheses that are computer operated. They're interested in these things for warfare purposes, for national defense purposes. And a big part of that is the surveillance. Some of these technologies go beyond surveillance, but the common denominator is they aim at controlling us, keeping us as close to their heels as they can, understanding and knowing everything that everybody's doing.
We're speaking with Dr. Elliot Cohen. He is a professor. He is also author of 25 books, including News Incorporated and Critical Thinking Unleashed. He's a first prize recipient of the Project Censored Award for his investigative reporting on the corporate threat to net neutrality, founder of International Journal of Applied Philosophy. He's a writer for several popular media venues, including Psychology Today. A recent book that we're discussing today on the Project Censored Show is Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. We'll be back with Dr. Elliot D. Cohen after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we're joined by Professor Elliot D. Cohen. One of his latest books is Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. And just before the break, Elliot, you had mentioned DARPA, and we were talking about some more recent manifestations of this spying and what's going on. Could you tell people and remind them what is DARPA and then continue where we left off?
It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and it's a branch of the Department of Defense, and it's the one that essentially funds research into innovative technologies for purposes of national defense. And one of the major interests that DARPA currently has is with respect to brain-machine, brain-computer interfaces.
And were they involved in the early days of the Internet, not Al Gore?
Yeah, Al Gore didn't create it. They did. You know, of course, they didn't create the Internet for the kinds of purposes we now use it for, but be it as it may, they do earn the right to that credit. But in any event, shall I tell you about the technologies?
Sure.
One of the technologies that they have a really strong interest in currently, and this is judging by the amount of patents, you know, that they've supported, is brain-computer interface programs. Now, what this does is essentially it keys into the thoughts that are going on in your mind, and it actually is able to intercept them.
Wow, thought police? Can you say that again?
Yeah, I mean, this is where the plot really thickens. Say you're playing a game, a computer game, and there's now these interfaces where you can think things and move a ball or do that. I think most people are familiar with these early versions of what we're talking about here. One of the reasons why this is being developed is to help people who are disabled to move, you know, cursors or even prosthetic limbs. They even have programs where this person who's operating the limb, for instance, can get feedback from the limb, so it feels like it's their own limb. These are closed loop, so to speak, as it's called, closed loop systems. So there's these constructive social uses, but all technologies can be used in a constructively social manner. But what the game plan is to use these technologies for other things like fighting, you know, wars and having soldiers who are able to manipulate these giant artillery with their thoughts, loaded or their own limbs. And that would give somebody a great advantage. We could talk about that as the war strategy and what is the ethics of that.
Well, Elliot, it's the stuff of science fiction films now,
yeah,
but it's not science fiction. It's real.
The point I'm bringing this up with respect to surveillance is that, for instance, Intel made a statement actually a few years ago that within the next decade, people are going to be logging onto the Internet with their minds. They're going to be able to search the Internet with their thoughts and download information. Now, essentially what this means is that people are going to be plugged into the Internet. We're not going to be talking about an Internet of Things. The next stage is an Internet of Persons. See, fill in the lines between the dots here.
Yeah, we're all Dropboxes.
Yeah, I mean, what that implies is that NSA is not going to be simply reading the emails that you're writing, but they're going to be actually have the capacity to read what's going on in your mind. And they're also going to have the capacity to download things into your mind, too. And now we're talking about why is privacy so important. Well, when you take this concern for privacy to this stage, are you a human being? Do you have dignity? I mean, you can be controlled. Your thoughts can be realigned. Your mind can be changed. And by the way, DARPA is doing work with remote control of emotions. So they're attempting to control people's emotions. And the game plan there is to have soldiers doing battle who are fatigued. They don't feel tired anymore because you give them a zap of an electrical charge to a certain point of the brain via remote control, and they're not tired anymore. They can change their affect from fear to not being afraid, so that they're willing to do stuff that they would otherwise not do. Now, just apply this kind of stuff to an Internet of Persons, where this kind of technology is used not just to spy on people, to find out what they're writing, but to actually control their thoughts, to key into their minds, and even change them.
Elliot, you're describing things that are potentially possible. I think the state of total information awareness is so severe, even today without going into mind control, that it's just boggling. I mean, and the media doesn't cover this. People don't really understand this. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, they're watching us. You can't say anything. But, you know, that this includes your credit card purchases, everything you do electronically, your bank account, everything, stuff we tend to think is private. But in reality, it's not. Our communications inside our home are not private anymore. This could be used for economic warfare, as you described in your book. I found the book chilling and has really made me think about what it means to be a human being in terms of privacy and having your own thoughts, because that is fading away in a very real way, and that it's quite philosophically concerning. And you're, yeah, you're an ethics professor, so you're framing it in that context as well. I find it really, really quite amazing. Now, DARPA, and you had a piece in there where you, Scientific Application International, has been working on these things. They say, well, there's too much volume. It's not a bother to privacy because it's too voluminous to be a threat. Do you buy that?
No, I don't, because the system is, as I mentioned, it only operates, there's a use for the system only if you put in strong selectors, which is the names of people and the like. And then you can call up specific individuals on it. And the thing is, the system lacks adequate government oversight. So just like the old system, we started talking about Echelon, how the exchange of information from the Brits to the Americans and vice versa was done to avoid the law. Now, there's another approach to the evasion of the law. We have the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, which is the law that's supposed to apply. But if you're collecting data overseas, for instance, there's no judicial oversight, so you can do what you want. And that's what's happening. And we're talking about a global system, so it's not just people from outside the United States whose data is on switches outside of the United States. It is the people who are from the United States switches are in there too. It goes by what's the most economic route to route the information. So essentially, what they're doing now is they're going overseas where FISA doesn't apply, and then what they're doing there is they're tapping information, and there's tons of information. Yeah, there's more information than what they can handle, but this information that's so personal and so unnecessary to acquire, and then there's the question of who are you going to trust? I mean, okay, maybe the next administration, I don't know about this, we got guys like Trump, you know, on the menu there as prospects. Who's going to be in control of all this information? Is it going to be somebody whom you can trust with no judicial oversight? I mean, is that really the system that we want in place? And so, no, I don't think just because there's so much information that degrades the danger of violation. And, you know, there's an ethics consideration here, too. Even if you argue that it's not affecting somebody by harming them in a physical sense, which I don't believe that's true. I think it does. But the idea of violating a person's right, this is my private information, and the government has access to it. And they're looking at this information to see if it's actually credible information. And what happens is, you see, when they collect an email, for instance, they don't just collect a single email. They collect them in packets. So if, for instance, they're looking for somebody whom they suspect is a terrorist and they use some strong selectors to get those individuals, what comes in is just not that email, but also a bunch of other emails, and they could be U.S. citizens. And then they see those. They have to look physically at those emails and decide whether or not, you know, they're part of their search, you know, and so they're looking. Now, if they see something interesting, there you go, you know. So, yeah, there's a lot of information, but when it starts to get strained down, it doesn't get strained down enough because essentially they do not have any safeguards. You know, you get U.S. citizens in there along with non-U.S. citizens, and the core you know, the FISE court had done something very, very unsettling, and that's to say that in one of their decisions, when they noticed this, they said, well, yeah, they're collecting U.S. citizens. They're not supposed to be, but they're not doing it deliberately. They're not doing it deliberately? Really? They are. I mean, they're just, and the claim was they don't have the technology to siphon out the U.S. citizens that they're collecting. But the answer is, yeah, they do. They have it. They're just not spending money on it. And this goes back, you mentioned, Peter, John Poindexter. Actually, in the early days after 2001, Poindexter proposed that there be a, what he called a privacy appliance attached to it and attached to the system. And essentially what this would do is we'd lock out data of U.S. citizens, and then you'd have to get a warrant to view that information. But this was defunded, and it never was developed. And so for the court to say it's not possible to have such devices is just false. I mean, they're just not spending the money because privacy, that's not what they care about. It's not, they don't want to spend money on people's privacy. They want to spend money on violating people's privacy.
We're speaking with Dr. Elliot D. Cohen. We're speaking about one of his recent books, Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. We'll continue our conversation with Elliot D. Cohen after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Dr. Elliot D. Cohen. One of his recent books is titled Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. Peter?
Elliot, you alluded to the idea that technologically we could build privacy into the system in stronger ways. What are some other regulations you would recommend to deal with these concerns?
Well, I actually created a set of model rules for this purpose, and it was developed from the analysis that I did in the book. And there's a bunch of them. The first one, A, says collections shall not include more data than what is useful or authorized for foreign intelligence gathering purposes. And then underneath it, data shall not be collected or maintained just in case it might become useful at a later time. And then wholly domestic communications, that is communications wherein the sender and all intended recipients are located in the United States or its territories, and communications from U.S. persons not in the U.S. to recipients in the U.S. shall not be collected. If such data is collected accidentally, it shall be immediately deleted. For purposes of the latter, data accidentally collected does not include data collected with foreknowledge, including the foreseeable collection of wholly domestic communications, even if the data is collected incidental to the collection of foreign intelligence. And one of the things, too, that I go on and talk about is content filters shall be used, which are configured to filter for and automatically delete unauthorized data, such as wholly domestic communications. So if there's data that is accidentally collected, it's not going to be maintained. It's going to be deleted automatically. And then there's de-identification filters, too, that can be used. And essentially, this blocks out information that is personal. You have to have a warrant based on probable cause to get it. So it goes on, you know, and talks on the portion B of it talks about conventional investigative methods shall guide and restrict the use of the network surveillance. So you don't use the system willy-nilly. If you have adequate evidence to suspect individuals, you can use the system to investigate it, but it's not used in a manner that is just fishing. You know, these fishing exhibitions that are going on with it aren't working. They're generating a lot of false positives. It's not doing any good.
So you're really making some recommendations to increase privacy. Why don't we know about this more? I mean, what's going on with media, both independent and corporate media, that we're not being told about these dangers to a greater degree? Of course, we've written a book, but, you know, this should be in the mass information systems. What's happening there?
There's a good answer to that, you know, and that's that the companies, the media corporations that are presenting the media to us are actually in bed with the government. I mean, it's strictly speaking, if you take a company like Comcast, which owns NBC and NBC Universal, they're delivering the news. Well, Comcast is one of the companies that's required to collect data. I mean, it's part of the FISA Amendments Act of 2008. They have to provide facility for government to collect this data, and they have to cooperate with them. So they're complicit in the process that they're reporting on. There's a quite an obvious conflict of interest. Years ago, when I was naive in learning ethics, I thought, well, this was pretty obvious. You couldn't have these conflicts of interest. They would be flagged and people wouldn't stand for it. But what's going on right now with giant news corporations is they're part of the problem. So they can't be the cure for the problem if they're actually part of the collection operation.
So, Elliot, what do you suggest then? It sounds like there's probably a multi-pronged or multi-tiered approach to dealing with these many interconnected problems. And then when people are confronted with this kind of information, it's oft overwhelming, right? We hear people, and we hear this about the Project Censored book every year, you know, it's a tsunami of information, or there's so much stuff going on. Where do we begin? How do you break that down for people? You've been dealing with these difficult subjects for a very long time over your career.
Yeah, well, this is a problem that, as you said, is multi-pronged, and there's a lot of different ways of going at it. I think Project Censored is an admirable source to making people aware of these things. The radio show that we're doing right now is reaching many people who may not have known about any of these issues. I think when people, the public, put pressure on government to be more transparent, you know, it's worth the effort for people to come together. In the book, I propose the possibility of having an internet forum where people can come together and there's greater transparency in what the processes of surveillance are internationally and what people are going to be willing to tolerate. This is an issue of informed consent, and it's not been treated as such. If you take a patient and you perform surgery on them without asking if they gave you permission, you violated them. It's not that far afield from the issues that we're talking about here. If you're violating somebody's privacy, you're doing something without their informed consent. So what we can eliminate the ethical problems here by coming together and government needing to be more transparent to the people and people putting pressure on government to actually disclose. Now, the patent response here is that, well, government has to keep all this stuff secret because otherwise it's going to endanger national security. But we're not talking about the details of the individual investigations here. We're not talking about that at all. That there's a rationale for not disclosing that information. We're talking about the general processes by which people's privacy are being invaded. If we understood what the process was, we could speak up and then we can work together to set it up, you know, using content filters and other devices that would prevent the ethics violations that we're talking about. And it's not too soon to talk about this because, as I said, the technologies are getting more and more invasive. And at some point, it's not going to be an item that we're going to easily address.
Elliot, you're scaring me, actually. I mean, the degree, there's nothing private. Literally. I mean, if you're talking to your attorney on the telephone about your case, that's not private.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Peter, because basically what's going on now is attorneys are not able to communicate with their overseas clients anymore via email. They actually literally have to get on a plane and fly overseas just to talk to their clients. And the American Bar Association is actually put in the rule of confidentiality. It's actually model rule 1-6 for those who like to test out model rules of professional responsibility and on the law. That's the rule, and it's actually added a clause to it addressing this kind of issue that lawyers have to be more careful. because, you know, what we're talking about here is a violation of the Sixth Amendment. We have a right to counsel, and we're not having it now because anything you say over the internet can conceivably fall into the hands of government. Now, if you're talking about a terrorist and a person who's allegedly committed an act of terrorism, maybe they didn't, but they're being accused of it and they have an attorney. The government is going to have any access to any of the information, you know, that's going to flow through those pipes.
That's obviously a sham of justice. Since you're rattling off some of these violations, could you rattle off a list in your mind of how this kind of surveillance culture violates our civil liberties? I mean, you know, even go down some of the Bill of Rights, or, you know, give people a list of what we're really talking about here.
Yeah, all right. Violates privacy of U.S. citizens by collecting personal correspondence. That's certainly happening, you know, regardless of what your other take is on it. They treat us like we're terrorist suspects, all of us. You're guilty until proven innocent. Incredible high false positive rate. So if you think that, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why should I be afraid of anything? Well, you might not be doing anything wrong, but you're still might be listed as a positive in
well, Elliot,
their books.
Elliot, given that they have access to this, given that this intelligence apparatus has access to all of this data, all of these files, can't they go and cherry pick things out of it to create a profile or to make it appear as though, like, let's say we're scholars that research, I don't know, foreign policy and terrorism and media propaganda. Couldn't that be cherry picked to make it appear as though we're doing something or we're people who we were really not?
Of course. That's right. And there's the ways of...
I didn't mean to get all X-Files there, but you know, yeah, where I'm going with this.
Yeah, exactly, because, you know, we're not talking about the kind of surveillance. We're not talking about warrants. The old FISA Act of 78, you had to have warrants, and they were pretty lax warrants. A FISA warrant you can get if you had probable cause that they were a foreign power. But that was it. If you had to get a FISA warrant to investigate, you couldn't do this kind of mass surveillance, and there was no need to actually create a new law to allow this kind of thing. So cherry picking, yeah, I mean, the court oversight is not there.
Just the electronic words, there's no way of understanding the humor or innuendo or game playing between individuals in terms of words that might sound threatening. When Echelon first happened, this was like 15 years ago when we covered Echelon, and I used to kid with my friends, you know, if all we said at the end of our conversation was the guns are buried in the backyard, maybe we would overwhelm them with trying to keep up with us. But they're
right,
collecting everything. Yeah.
Just take it out of context. And that's one of the problems of the kinds of technologies that we're talking about. They're great syntax manipulators, but the semantics, the meaning part of it gets extracted. And that's one of the big challenges of artificial intelligence, to try to build semantics into pure syntax, pure symbol manipulation.
Artificial
and that's what
meaning.
You're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's just extracting artificial meaning and really projecting meaning where there may not be. Let's wrap up with, again, back to our list. So we're talking about violations of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, 10th, 14th. Where else are we going?
I think it's worth looking at the First Amendment violation with respect to freedom of the press, you know, because quite obviously journalists get their information from sources, and unless those sources are face-to-face, you know, if there's any kind of communication over a wire, then those individuals are subject to a knowledge base, a database of NSA. And, you know, people are not so willing to disclose very potentially dangerous or incriminating information if they know they're going to end up in an NSA database. And I think that's an important consideration, because it basically the system chills off journalist sources.
That's a huge problem, and we've talked about that at the Project for years, the chilling effect. In fact, last year one of our stories was the Penn Center talking about the chilling effect that this all has on writers.
There's something that I think I should mention, too, about upstream programs that are being conducted overseas. There's two especially troublesome overseas upstream programs. One is called Muscular. Ever hear of it?
I've heard of it, but I know little of it.
In Censor?
No.
Okay, well, actually, Muscular collected 181 million records in a month, and In Censor collected over 14 billion in a month. And according to the internal NSA publication, they're collecting, quote-unquote, too much. They don't need it, but they're collecting it. They're even collecting videos or Yahoo.
Yeah, YouTube cat. Videos of your cat.
Or sexual ones that are in the same database. And I want to emphasize, this collection is not subject to FISA. So these programs, Must Hear and Censor, are totally unsupervised by legal authorities.
Well, Elliot Cohen, thank you so much for illuminating this, you know, very dark and underreported topic. Dr. Elliot Cohen, author of 25 books, one of your latest books at Palgrave Macmillan is Technology of Oppression, Preserving Freedom and Dignity in an Age of Mass Warrantless Surveillance. Elliot, do you have a website, someplace you can direct people so they can follow more of your work? You're prolific and you're always doing things, and we're going to be doing some things here with you at Project Censored in our next book and at our 40th anniversary conference, but can you tell people where they might go to find out more?
A lot of writings that I do, and some of them are on political issues, but many of them are on issues of emotional adjustment too, and dealing with crises and situations, you know, in life. And I think it's all connected. My blog on What Would Aristotle Do on Psychology Today is a good place to see some of my work and to contact me as well. So I would suggest starting there.
Professor Elliot D. Cohen, thank you so much for rejoining us today on the Project Censored Show about this very critical and ongoing issue.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer Anthony Fest, our engineer Erica Bridgman. Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We will see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.